I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, my guest is the author of Real Artists Don't Starve, Timeless Strategies for Thriving in the New Creative Age, Jeff Goines, best-selling author of The Art of Work. Thank you so much, Jeff, for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me, Lisa. Glad to be here.
I've actually followed your blog for a long time before you were a published author, and you made a lot of connections with people, did a lot of great interviews, and developed this huge readership, this huge blog readership that you were able to leverage into a book deal and then other books and then eventually the Art of Work. And it was during that process where you were growing a following and growing all these readers that I was wondering then when I read your book, did you have a starving artist mentality during that period? Is this something that you developed out of, or did you always have this idea like, I'm just going to have to do whatever it takes to make sure that I can write for a living?
I definitely had a starving artist mentality. Writing was one of those games that I never felt like I could win. So in my 20s, I worked for a mission organization where we would send missionaries all over the world to different countries and do service work. And I was the marketing director there. And I always loved writing, but I wasn't quite sure how to make a go as a writer. I didn't even know if that was something I could do. And people told me, you know, you can't really make a living as a writer. And so I assumed that was true. But every few years, I would try. I'd start a blog. I'd try to do this thing that you saw me do not too long ago, several years ago. I'd been trying to do this for like 7 or 8 years at that point. And I would start a blog. You know, I was like taking a shower. I'd get an idea. I'd start a blog based on that idea. And after a month, you know, or two, it didn't take off. I would quit. Mm-hmm. And I'd move on to the next idea. And I did this for years. I think I had like 7 or 8 blogs doing this that I had abandoned that are still like somewhere as orphans out, you know, on the internet somewhere. And so, yeah, I very much had this like, well, I guess this just isn't going to work for me, woe is me kind of mentality. And it took a few wake up calls for me to realize that I was really going to do this, if I was going to pursue writing as a vocation, then I was going to have to change my mindset.
Hmm. Well, was there something that happened that switched you to a different way of thinking, or was it little things along the way?
Both. Yeah. I mean, I definitely had a couple of wake up calls. One was when I was, I think, 27. I kept feeling this itch to write. And like I said, I'd been trying to do this and failing at it for years, but also quitting, you know, and I was really frustrated with myself. Mm-hmm. You know, when you want something, but you don't want it badly enough, whatever that is, like a relationship, personal transformation, a clean house, losing weight, whatever it is, like I want this, but maybe not like as bad as I think I want it because I keep sabotaging myself. Mm. And I was frustrated. I felt kind of internally conflicted. But I had been working at this job for like going on 5, almost 6 years. And I was starting to wonder, is this what like my life is supposed to look like? If I fast forward 10 years from now and I'm in my, you know, late 30s, approaching 40, am I going to be racing towards a midlife crisis? And I just sort of anticipated that, yeah, I was. And I didn't, it wasn't that I hated my job. I liked it. I was good at it. I wasn't going to get fired. I kept getting raises. I had a good relationship with my boss, but it just felt very comfortable, which actually made me very uncomfortable. And I started reading and going to seminars and conferences. And there's a quote by Parker Palmer, who's a Quaker. You may be familiar with him. And he says, before I can tell my life what I want to do with it, I need to listen to my life telling me who I am. And when I started listening to my life through talking to friends, going to conferences, it seemed that it was telling me that I was supposed to be a writer. And the bit. So, you know, just little things like going to a conference about finding your dream job. And this speaker said, hey, who here doesn't know what their dream is? And I raised my hand. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, like, and half the room raised their hand, by the way. And all of a sudden I felt not so alone. And then the speaker said, well, I think you're lying. I think you do know what your dream is. You're just afraid to admit it.
Mm.
And I opened my notebook and I wrote down writer. And then that night I took it home and I shared it with my wife. I said, look at this thing on the notebook. It says I'm supposed to be a writer. I know what my purpose is. And she said, are you kidding me? I've been telling you that for the past 5 years and you go to some conference and now you know? And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, sometimes we're the last people to recognize who we really are. And not long after that, I joined a coaching group that my work paid for. And the second meeting, we met every other month for a year. It was like a paid mastermind kind of experience. And we met every month here in Nashville where I live. And the second meeting, one of the participants, not the coach, you know, one of the clients, one of my peers essentially, asked me what my dream was. Again, that word. And I said, you know, I don't know. Even after I had like written it in the notebook, you know?
Mm.
And he said, really? Because I would have thought that your dream was to be a writer. It just seems kind of obvious to me. And all he knew about me, he knew me for 2 months. All he knew about me was that I had a blog and that, you know, apparently I was talking about writing or something. I don't know. I wasn't saying these sort of things. And yet he saw something in me that I refused to recognize myself. And so finally I said, okay, yeah, I guess I'd like to be a writer someday, but that'll probably never happen, which is totally a starving artist thing to say, you know? And he just looked at me and he'd been through a lot of therapy, you know? So he had a way of like saying things that kind of cut through, you know, all the mental clutter. And he said, Jeff, you don't have to want to be a writer. You are a writer. You just need to write. And so all these things were happening over a matter of months. And so finally it tipped me over the edge. And that next morning I got up, I had this blog that I was sort of playing with. I took it very seriously from then on out. And I said, every day I'm going to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, because I heard that was like the magic hour where, you know, the writing muses visited you. And I'm going to write and I'm going to publish an article every single day. And I did that for an entire year. And, in a way, you know, the rest is history.
Was that when you changed your domain to Jeff Goins Writer?
Yeah, goinswriter.com. Yeah, so basically I had bought that domain years ago because I had done – I tried to buy jeffgoins.com. I can't. It's some realtor in Maryland. And I was like, well, like, you know, I want to be a writer and I'll probably always do this. And I mean, I just didn't think a ton about it. So I had this website that was basically a static website where I would put articles, because I would occasionally write articles for small magazines and online publications. And so I had, you know, I dabbled with this stuff, like I said, for years, kind of playing the amateur. And so this was a place where I kind of kept my portfolio and I would use it to get side gigs, which I did on occasion, you know, writing articles for a few hundred bucks a piece. And I realized, oh, I need a blog. I've got to build a platform. I really want to be a writer. I want to write books. I want to live the life of a writer, whatever that means. And so I understood that I needed an audience. And when my friend Paul said, you are a writer, you just need to write, I realized, okay, that's the one thing I'm not doing. Let's start doing it. From then on out, I started calling myself a writer. I started acting like it, and eventually I became one.
Hmm. It's just, I guess fear was just holding you back, maybe fear of failure or?
I think it was fear of success.
Fear of success.
I think I was afraid of what this might require of me.
Hmm.
I've always been somebody who has at the same time wanted the spotlight and always been uncomfortable once I received it. Mm. You know, so I want attention, but then I don't really know what to do with it. You know, so throughout my life, I have always dabbled in creative endeavors, art, music, acting, and I love sharing a message in front of an audience. I love that thrill, but I'm also kind of shy. And I just think I was scared that I might try it and it might fail, but I was also scared that what if this works? And is this really what I want to do? And, you know, I mean, I think those are somewhat common fears to have in your mid to late 20s, where you're still trying to figure out who you are. But for me, you know, all of those conversations were like verification, affirmation that this was more than just a good idea. I really felt it was a calling.
Well, you mentioned in your book that starving artists get the money side all wrong. And I thought that was a really salient point, because I think they think, well, the art comes first, and that means I have to make all these sacrifices, and that means, you know, I can't have a good life or a life that pays the bills or something like that. And maybe you can explain a little bit of what that means, that they would get the money side all wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think they make money the enemy, and it's not. It's also not the point. So if there's sort of two extremes, one is the starving artist, the other extreme would be the sellout, right? The person who creates art just for commercial gain and for no other reason, and is essentially, you know, exploiting themselves and their creations. And obviously that's a super subjective thing. Like, I don't think you get to tell somebody else they're a sellout, but I think that we can call ourselves sellouts. I think we know when we're not being true to who we really are. I know you're into spiritual formation. I don't know if you've read any Thomas Merton.
Oh yeah.
Love Thomas Merton. You know, he amongst others, talk about sort of the false self versus the true self. And one of the things he says about the false self, which is just, you know, it's the role that you play in the world where people go, hey, you're really good at that. You're like, I am. Oh, I'll do more of that to get that positive affirmation. And it may or may not actually be in alignment with who I truly am at, you know, kind of a deep soul level. And he says, you know, one of the problems with this shadow self is that if we pay attention to it long enough, we start to think it's the real thing. And he also says the hardest illusions are, you know, to recognize are the ones that we have about ourselves. And so, yeah, I mean, I think this is an issue with the idea of money and art, and ultimately what it means to sell out. On one hand, being a sellout is this idea that you have kind of put the cart before the horse and you are now making art to make money. I don't think that's the point. Now, if you go to the other extreme, you've got the starving artist, and they're just making art to make art, art for art's sake, which I also think is not the point. I think art is intended to transform someone or something. I think that's the point of art. And maybe not everybody agrees with that definition. That's fine. But I think there's lots of great reasons to create things just for yourself. I call that journaling or therapy or self-care. I don't call those things art, because the point of art is that it's supposed to change something or someone. And so when I was approaching my art as a writer, I knew I didn't want to sell out, but I also knew I didn't want to starve. And so I thought, what is, what's the middle way? Like, what is the best of both worlds? And I think that's this idea of what I call a thriving artist. And I think it's best illustrated by a conversation that somebody once had with Walt Disney, where when he was really at the pinnacle of his success, somebody wrote him an article, or a letter, I mean, and said, you know, like, you're just making films so that you can make money. Like, that's the point of it. And this was at the point where he was actually making money, because for basically the first half of his career, he had multiple bankruptcies and was constantly borrowing money from the bank and practically going bankrupt and just kind of making it work. And he finally got to this point where they were starting to be profitable and things were working well, and they were growing into this empire. And he said, no. We don't make films to make money. We make money so that we can make more films. And as easy as it is to say, oh, you know, I don't care about the money, it's dishonest, because you have to care. Like, that, you don't say, I don't care about paying bills. You don't say, I don't care about art supplies or a computer on which to write. And again, I'm not somebody who thinks like you need to make as much money as possible because you deserve it. Like I'm not in that camp, but I do believe that we have to, if we want to be real artists. I mean, we're doing it for a living. We're acting like a professional. We're spending hours a day on our craft, not minutes, because it just, you know, it takes time. We have to make enough money so that we can afford to make our art and live from it.
Yeah. And sometimes it's really undervalued. You wouldn't undervalue, you know, someone who's in other trades, maybe like a nurse or, you know, a mechanic or something like that, where you would maybe pay up front or something in some ways. But then if there's something you're doing that's valuable, that is a creative endeavor, why shouldn't it be something that gets paid for?
Yeah. And I mean, I get that. Like, art is subjective, and taking my car to the mechanic addresses a practical need that I have that, like, hanging a painting on my wall doesn't satisfy in the same way. So it's a different economy. Lewis Hyde, in his book, The Gift, talks about how art lives in both what's called the gift exchange economy and the market economy. Market economy is, I've got a need, you've got a service or product that meets that need, we exchange value, we're good, right? Like, I want to write a book, I need a computer, I go to the Apple store, I buy a computer, my car doesn't work, I take it to a mechanic, I get a tune-up. It's an equal exchange. Exchange economy is a whole different economy where I create things that, you know, have some sort of value, but it's unclear, you know, what that is. And I give you gifts and you give me gifts. And it's, you know, it's more of a pre-industrial kind of economy where everybody's serving the needs of the community in, you know, their own little way. And the only way it works is if you keep paying the gift forward. And if at any point somebody goes, hey, thanks for the gift, I'm good, it doesn't work. And if you've ever been in you know, certain parts of Latin America, Africa, you know, Pacific Islands, where you've got more tribal societies, no matter how poor these places are, you enter these villages and somebody will come and present you with a gift. And Lewis Hyde says one of the reasons why it's hard to make a living as an artist is because it's both, it lives in both economies. Like, there is the constraint of, on the artist, of I've got to make a living, so I've got to sell my wares. And yet there is this reality that making something creative doesn't, particularly in, you know, the 21st century, you know, kind of in this almost post-industrial era where we are so trained to think this has to be valuable, it has to be helpful, it has to be practical. And if it's not, I'm not going to pay for it. And so there is this real tension. But in the book, I argue that you can dance between these two different worlds and you can find ways to make money through your creative efforts that also fund the creation of your art. And it's not like the point of being a thriving artist is not that you would, like, create stuff and you'd go to the market, people would buy all that stuff. The point is that you've got to find a way to make this work for you. And one of the things that I think is really important is this idea of a portfolio lifestyle where, you know, you're doing more than one thing. You've got this thing over here that makes some money, but then you're, you know, you've got this type of work over here that makes less money, or maybe, you know, it's just something that is more of a passion project. And we've got these different kinds of work that we do. When we put them all together, we make a living, and we are able to chase the things that we are passionate and curious about that give us life and also serve the needs of others.
Mm. One of the things I wanted you to go into a little bit, and you really explain it a lot in the book, so, you know, I urge people to read the whole thing in the book because there's no way you're going to be able to unpack it as I ask you now. But on page 27, you say, before you become an artist, you must become a thief. And on page 31, we find our voice by mimicking the voices of others. At first blush, when you read this, it can seem a little unseemly or a little disingenuous to think, oh, like a ripoff artist, or what should I, you know, what do you do with that when, you know, you're not, of course, saying, yeah, just thieve your way to prominence and stuff like that. But what is it about borrowing or using other people's things. Can you explain the nugget of what you mean by that part of your book?
Yeah, well, first of all, we have this very precious idea that an artist, a genius, is somebody who sat alone in a studio or in a cabin in the woods somewhere, came up with some brilliant idea inspired by the muses, and then brought it into existence all by themselves without any sort of outside influence. And it's just not true, ever. Not true. I've never found, well, if you dig deep enough, you cannot find a story. I've yet to find one of a brilliant creative person who came up with their best idea without building on the ideas who've come before. So I think we have to begin by realizing our heroes did this. They were thieves. And I get that that is a controversial word. And I would use a less controversial word if it communicated the connotation, but I can't find one because you really are stealing. and Austin Kleon talks about this in Steal Like an Artist. And he says, you know, what is the difference between a good artist and a bad artist? The good artist steals from multiple sources. The bad artist steals from one source. So, you know, if I go to your website and I copy an article that you've written word for word, maybe change one or two words, and I repurpose it and reuse it without permission and call it my own work, that's plagiarism and that's illegal. It's wrong. But if I read your article and 100 other articles, I cite my sources, and then I basically curate that information into my own version of all that information, have I created anything new? Not really. I just stole from enough people, put it together that it looked original. And the historian Will Durant talks about this. He says that nothing is new except arrangements. And so I think that our job as creative people, and we're all creating our lives, we're creating with our work, we're all doing creative work every single day. I just spoke with an entrepreneurial team at a company about this, and somebody asked about imposter syndrome. And I said, the best cure for imposter syndrome is to realize that everybody that you look up to, that you think you are copying, they're copying somebody else, right? So Bono was asked when U2 was very, very popular, how did you get that U2 sound? And he said, we were just trying to sound like all these other bands and we weren't good enough. And this is what came out. And so I think the job of an artist has to begin with imitation. Michelangelo, his first commission was a forgery, literally a forgery. And in the Renaissance, this was not seen as a bad thing. It was proof of your talent. If you could copy, he copied somebody from Roman antiquity and they buried it in the ground. They dusted it up and they brought this statue of a faun, I believe, to this cardinal. He and this art dealer did, and said, hey, here's a, you know, piece of, you know, 1,000-year-old statue, which, you know, in the time of the Renaissance, what they were trying to do was create this rebirth of antique culture, philosophy, and art. And the guy bought it and then realized it was a forgery. And instead of chastising Michelangelo and asking for a refund, he hires him. He goes, you're good. Let's do something else. And so I think this idea that you create something original by yourself needs to die. And then I think we have to become good, honest thieves. And what that means is you study the work of the greats. Then you steal from it, not just from one, but from many. Remember, nothing is new except arrangement. Then you ultimately curate what you copy. You rearrange it into your unique version of it, and then you share it with the world.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think adding your own experience, your own voice, it goes through your own lens, too. It's not a carbon copy once you've had your fingerprints all over it. And I think that is part of art, that you can see the influences. Like when you take an art history class, the influences are so obvious as you move down through art through the ages that it's not like anything ever comes out of a vacuum. It always comes out of something else. I think that's a really excellent point.
Yeah, and to kind of dovetail on that, this idea of finding your voice, I also think is problematic if voice is tucked somewhere deep inside of us. And look, I believe in a soul and a true self, like I'm a spiritual person. But I believe as a writer, I find my voice by copying the voices of other writers, trying those on like coats and seeing which one of them fit. And over time, you end up borrowing different techniques and styles from different people, and you bring it all together in this hodgepodge that becomes yours. And it is this rearrangement of all your influences. A great example of this is Twyla Tharp, who is a world-renowned dancer and choreographer. And when she started dancing in New York City, she would go into the dance studios, she would stand behind the other dancers, and she would literally mimic movement for movement what they were doing. And she says skill gets imprinted through action. She talks about this in her book, The Creative Habit. You literally have to copy the greats who have come before you so that you can find your voice. And I think we live in this age where everybody is hyper individualistic, a little bit egocentric, and we just think we have some great original thing to share with the world. And that's not the way great ideas and great things get made. They get made by you being a deep and devoted student of the work that has come before, honoring that, copying it, and then eventually building upon it.
Another thing you mentioned in your book is to be stubborn about the right things. I thought that was an interesting point. Would you mind mentioning a little bit about what that means?
One of the things that I wanted to do with this book is go, like, what are the things that we creative people, I'm a creative, as I mentioned, art has been a form of my life in one way or the other for most of my life. What are the things that I've always felt like were disadvantages? And maybe they're not always disadvantages. And one of those things was stubbornness, right? I was talking to a group of creative people, designers, artists, musicians, not too long ago. And I said, who here is stubborn? Who here has ever had sort of a bullheaded idea about this is the way it should be? And everybody raised their hand, you know? I think that's one of the things that like makes great art is you're stubborn about certain things. You've got taste, you've got style. And the challenge here is to not be stubborn about everything. So stubbornness is actually an asset if you can harness it, right? Otherwise, it's like this, wild stallion, running amok. But if you can harness it and be stubborn about a few things, the few things that matter, then you are going to succeed. And this isn't just true in art. It's also true in business and leadership. Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, said, "We are stubborn on vision, but flexible on details." I find that things don't go well for me when I flip those, when I get stubborn about the details and I've completely lost sight of the vision. So be stubborn on the big picture. Where do you want to be in 10 years? What kind of legacy do you want to leave? What is the kind of work that you would be proud to be remembered for? And then how can you be flexible about the details that will help you or prevent you from getting there?
Yeah, that is a really good point. Sometimes people think it has to be sort of one way or the other, and not realizing there's nuance there that was a really good point in the book. I appreciated that. One of the things that you mentioned is something about apprenticeship, and I have I've been approached, and I'm sure people approach people like you and other people who have had success and. Can you mentor me? Can you apprentice me? It's like getting free help, And
right.
You talk about apprenticeship as being a really big part of being successful in your creative work, but that it has to be approached really differently. So how do you suggest people find an apprenticeship type of situation and think of it differently in a way that could help them and not be a burden to the person who is going to really be helping them out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the wrong way to do this is to go to somebody and say, "Will you mentor me? Can I pick your brain?" Every day I get an email from somebody that says, "Hey, I want to talk to you about such and such." It will only take 30 minutes. That's a long time. I mean, And I don't have 30 minutes. Most of my day is scheduled. And if I have 30 minutes, I'd rather go home and hang out with my kids or write for a little bit. 30 minutes is like only 30 minutes is not the right thing to say. I think the problem with this is you go to somebody, an influencer, a would-be mentor, somebody that you look up to, and you ask them for their time. You are no different from every other taker that they've experienced. And you may have all of the best intentions in mind, but they just simply don't have time to respond to every request for their time. And one of the ways to stand out from everybody asking for time or a favor or just 5 minutes is to do the opposite, right? Which is not to ask, but to demonstrate that you've already taken advice that they've given. I call this the case study strategy. And it works really, really well because 90% of the time people don't do it. And I have a little formula for it. I don't love formulas, but I think this works pretty well. This has worked well for me, and I've seen it work well for other people as well. Instead of reaching out to that person saying, "Will you mentor me?" Let them know a way that they have already mentored you. Because what mentors, influencers, famous people who are interested in developing other people, you know, leaders, what they want is they want to know that you're trustworthy. They want to know that if they invest time, ideas, energy into you, there's going to be a return. You're actually going to do something with it. And the sad reality about advice is most of us don't take it when we receive it because it's free, because we don't agree with it, whatever. And I think a great way to kind of get to the front of the line is to do this. And here's the little formula. Dear so-and-so, dear Lisa, thanks for X. It helped me do Y. Now what about Z? Here'd be an example for you. Big fan of your podcast. Dear Lisa, thanks for your podcast. I really love the episode with Jeff where you talked about starving artists. You know, it helped me think differently about this. So appreciate the work that you've done. And the better the thank you, the deeper it is, the more you acknowledge like the real thoughtful work that they've done, the more sincere it's going to come across, obviously. It helped me do this. Now, what about Z? Have you ever considered interviewing, so-and-so? And you know, I would love to hear an interview about that. Thanks. And if you do this enough times, the Z, the ask, can gradually become, you know, a higher stake kind of thing. You know, I love the work that you're doing, da da da. I'd love to interview you sometime. You know, would that be okay? And it's not that they will always say yes, but these kinds of requests, like I said, they happen 10% of the time. So they just naturally stand out. I can tell you thousands of times people have emailed me or reached out to me on social media and said, "Jeff, loved your book." I can count on maybe a few hands how many times people said, "I love this part specifically about your book, and here's how it helped me." And I don't know about you, Lisa, but when people respond to my work like that, I appreciate somebody saying, "I loved your book," but it's an easy thing to say. It's a throwaway compliment. I don't disparage it, but it's an easy thing to say. The amount of joy that I feel when somebody gives me a specific compliment is like 100 times something general, like, "I loved your such and such." And so this is a way that you can get somebody to, over time, mentor you, do favors for you, hang out with you, talk to you, give you advice, not by saying, "Will you mentor me?" but by saying, "You're already mentoring me. Here's how. Here's what I'm doing. What else do you have for me?" You do that with 10 people, I promise you, somebody is going to respond positively.
Well, because it's not so selfish the way you're approaching people. You know, it's not like, help me, do for me. It's a lot more considerate. And
Yeah. You're vetting yourself too, mm-hmm. right? Like if I get an email from you, I don't know if you're crazy. I don't know if you're a psychopath, or I don't know if you're a really good person because I can't see the fruit.
Right.
But if you've done some stuff, and obviously you could like lie about it, but you know, if somebody emails me, and this happened not too long, "Hey, I read your book, The Art of Work, and I launched this website as a result of it because this is my calling." I'm like, "Wow, that's cool. I can see the website and I can mm-hmm. see the article where they said, here's how The Art of Work helped me launch this thing." You know, like it's real. It's tangible almost, you know? So it's just a more powerful way to get in front of influential, busy people and say, "Hey, I'm not like that big, long line that just wants your autograph."
Right. Yeah. Well, that's great advice. Thank you for sharing that. I think Tim Ferriss mentioned something similar too, and how he also had gotten started in similar ways. And it's just building relationships and building legitimate connections instead of kind of being on the take. I think that's just wise. It's just wise advice, and it's great. And one of the things that you do in your portfolio life is you offer classes, and you're going to be doing Creative Live soon. You've done that in the past, and you have your podcast, Portfolio Live. And maybe you can talk a little bit about who you have on there, who it's geared toward, and for anybody who's not listening to it already, I've really appreciated the ones, especially that you've done with your. She's not your editor, I don't think. Is she your? I don't know. It was a whole bunch of them. Came out recently. Yeah. It was like five of them, and it was right. Like how to write a book. I thought those were great, and it was neat that it went back in time as you were crafting your book, and I was like, this is really cool that we get to see the process of the book as you're working on it. You didn't even have a title for it yet in some of them. That was really useful, because seeing how the creative process works and how a book is really messy and gets put together in kind of all the blood and guts. I thought that was really, really interesting. And I know more people would probably be really interested in your show too. So maybe you could just go about, like, why did you start it? Why do that as something else that you do besides writing and blogging?
I started a podcast. I think the reason I start anything is because I'm curious about it. I don't know that it's going to work, but it sounds fun. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like, I really enjoy talking with people. I'm about to take the podcast on the road and like go to some of these people that I'm interviewing. But I started the Portfolio Live because I didn't want to just talk about writing, which is something I was doing a lot on my blog. Mm-hmm. I wanted to interview and talk about the creative life and how it was made up of many different facets. Like, the idea of the Portfolio Live is the idea that you treat your work like a portfolio of investments. You know, you've got different holdings, you know, you've got different folders for different things that you do. And that's the way most people are. They're not just, like they have one thing that they do. And so it really has become a show where I'm talking about how the creative life really works, which is very mysterious to a lot of people. And so I interview a lot of guests, authors, speakers, entrepreneurs, but people who at their core would think of themselves as creatives. And we talk about the different aspects of their lives. And as you mentioned, I share some of the projects that I'm working on and how that actually works, and just kind of pulling back the curtain a little bit. But yeah, I started it just because I wanted to have fun conversations with people that might otherwise turn me down. And so I was like, well, I want to talk to you. So we'll record it and put it on the internet so other people can listen to the conversation too. And I still think that's the most fun part of it.
Yeah. I started my podcast in 2015, and I thought, I wonder if, if I could read a book and someone would just want to talk about it, the author would just want to talk about it. It's kind of like, it's like a dream come true. Like,
amazing.
Do you want to just talk? Yeah, I do. I was like, what? Why are you kidding me? So it's a ton of fun. And then everybody can sit in on it too. So this has been awesome. I'm wondering if you can give people a little more information about where they can find you.
Sure. Yeah. You can find all my stuff on the internet, if you've heard of it. And you could just Google my name, Jeff Goines. I mean, you'll find all that stuff there. And Goines is spelled like coins, but with a G. Or you can go to my website. You can learn more about the book, the podcast, the blog, etc. And that's just goineswriter.com, G-O-I-N-S writer.com.
Awesome. Do you have any final words of wisdom you'd like to leave us with?
We talked a lot about being a starving artist. I think you can be a starving artist in any aspect of your life, in business, in your relationships, in work, in play. And really, it just comes down to, are you taking this thing seriously enough to want to make it thrive? Or are you apologizing for it and thinking about it in small terms? And the whole point of the book is, being a starving artist today is a choice, not a necessary condition of doing creative work.
It's very good. I love the message of your book. And I think it's going to encourage a lot of people to just keep plugging away and not think that things have to be one certain way. Like they have to make all these sacrifices to do just one particular thing, or have to be really stubborn, and they can maybe see things in a different light. It's been great to read your book, and I wish it all the best. I think, has it already been a bestseller? Has it already made the list?
Yeah, it did hit the Wall Street Journal bestseller list the first week it came.
Thought so. Yeah, congratulations for that.
Thank you. Thanks.
Awesome. This has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much, Jeff.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lisa. Have a good day.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.